We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangle, the meditation podcast from Gaiam. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who have devoted their lives to teaching and helping others through meditation. In today's episode, Emily Fletcher, founder of Ziva Meditation and a teacher on the Meditation Studio app, sits down with Ariel Garten, the founder of Muse. Muse is a relatively new brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate. Ariel's studies in neuroscience and her entrepreneurial spirit inspired her to create this wearable device that tracks your brain, giving you real-time feedback while you're meditating. She's here to tell us her story.
I'm so thankful to get to spend some time with you and learn more about you and your journey. So I've had the joy of using a Muse. I was actually one of the first. My agent a long time ago said, hey, do you want to try this prototype? And I said, yes, please. So I know what it is, but can you explain to our listeners, what is Muse? How does it work?
Sure. So Muse is a brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate. It's this beautiful little device that you slip on with sensors in the forehead and behind the ears, and it tracks your brain activity in real time. And it gives you real-time feedback to know what's going on in your mind during a focused attention meditation. It translates your meditation into sound. And the metaphor we use is your mind is like the wind. So when you're thinking, distracting, your brain's bouncing all over the place, you hear it as windy or stormy. And as you guide yourself to clear, focused attention, it quiets those winds. So you end up with this very beautiful experience of your own mind where you hear when it's wandering and you hear where it's quiet, and it helps you guide yourself into that space of quiet. And then it actually tracks what your brain is doing. You can go back and look at your distractions, look at when you're deeply engaged, what motivated those. You get points and scores, which are all very secondary to the value that the experience gives you. And then you can track and see how you improved over time. It makes meditation both this really beautiful experience of being able to engage with yourself in this new way, as well as something that gives you objective feedback so that you can take that data and help yourself move forward.
Was there a drop-in moment, like, you know, where you were in the shower and it went, oh, this thing, I have this idea for this wearable device? Or was it something that you were working towards? Like, I know I want to make this thing. I don't know what it looks like yet, but let me chip away. Like Michelangelo, you know, unveiling the sculpture as he chips away the rock.
Oh, it was a chipping away process. So whenever I create a work of art, it's, always different than what I conceived it would be. Mm-hmm. So I can sit there and in my head, you know, craft something. But once you actually sit down and begin working with the materials, you immediately have new ideas and you see new solutions and you see new combinations of the things that you're bringing together. And from there, it develops and it evolves and it is a co-creation between the work and you. And making Muse was definitely the same thing. Making Muse started with many, many years ago an interest in the brain and how it worked, and then an interest in business and actually how we can use neuroscience principles to inform and transform business and actually bring solutions to a wider audience as a result of it. And then from there, I started working in a lab where I was sonifying EEG at first for epilepsy.
Mm-hmm. And then, can you tell us what sonify means?
To turn into sound.
Mm-hmm.
So EEG is this typical way to diagnose an epileptic seizure, and typically it's done by eye, but using your ear is actually sometimes a better way of detecting patterns that are irregular than using your eye. And then from there, I started to create art experiences with brainwaves so you can actually hear your brain and make music with it. And then from there, got to using EEG for meditation. So it was this evolving and shaping process. It wasn't, you know, an aha moment waking up. The common thread is the burning desire to create things that are meaningful and transformative. And that takes many, many forms. And the form that it's ultimately ended up in today is Muse.
This, I think, is big. This is really big. It's like we have the science to know that meditation is good for you. What I'm fascinated in is, can we start to see, how about this 1,000 people meditating in Central Park? How does that impact everyone else in Manhattan? You know, or the people meditating in Toronto? How does that impact the people in Vancouver if they're, you know, thinking about them? That, to me, would be an exciting next frontier. Or is that maybe already happening?
It's a fantastic question that I actually wonder myself. As we all are engaging in activity together, there's a few papers that show that two people can, it's typically done around therapists, that a therapist and a client end up with their brainwaves entrained. So they end up having a similar rhythm to their brain activity. So when we are in concert with one another, how does that impact one another? How does that impact the world around us? We can see from the social aspects what's happening from a biological aspect.
Yeah, I feel like we're not so many years away from it. Like even skin acidity or heart rate monitors, I think would be enough to see if there was a marked drop in people's overall stress rates. What's been the most exciting report that you've had back from a Muse user? Like someone said, you know, this thing has changed my life in this way, or this, I used to have this ailment and now I don't, or is any feedback like that happen?
Endlessly, all the time.
Mm.
I had a mom the other day tell me that her son with anxiety has been musing, and he muses every day, and the change that she has seen has been spectacular. And like, we both kind of started to cry that this 16-year-old kid who had anger problems and who was, you know, not the most connected to himself and didn't have tools and resources, got this tool and just like appropriated it. It was like the family muse, and he's like, I'm taking it.
Mm.
And uses it and sees transformation in his life. And like, life is now easier and he's more able to manage and cope. Like, you think about how many 16-year-olds don't have the language to communicate with themselves and they don't have the language to ask for help in that. And so to be able to be given a tool that lets you work within yourself, mm-hmm. and have that tool be useful and powerful and see the transformation and see the change, and then have a language that you can use because you have that tool to talk to your mom about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, my heart exploded.
Mm. Do you have a lot of child Muse users?
So the headband actually fits from about 13 and up. We have a lot of teenage Muse users. And then we have, you know, tens of thousands of people all over the world using it.
And where are you going next? What's your big vision? What's your dream? If you had a magical wand and you could wave it and anything would happen with Muse, with meditation in 5 years, 10 years, what does that look like for you?
So my magical wand is that we'd ultimately get to a place. I mean, this is a really idealistic magic wand. So I'm going to start way on the edge.
I want a big fat magic wand.
Yeah, the big fat magic wand is ultimately we end up in a place with world peace because people's fear and their scarcity thinking and their anxiety has diminished, and we don't need to be defensive, separate creatures from one another.
Mm.
So that's the big dream.
Beautiful. You know, it sounds so ideological, but I don't think that we're that far away from it. And we're you and I, you know, are so fortunate to be a part of these communities. And I see these entrepreneurs that are having such incredible social impact and making money.
Yep.
They don't have to be mutually exclusive. And so it even though it sounds a little pie in the sky, I think that it is coming. And I think that there's this influence of feminine in the workforce. And that's from men and women, but just more of a feminine energy, which I think is exciting. And I love seeing women like you, you know, being so successful in especially tech and neuroscience spaces. It's awesome.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And so when you do the work back on this grand, you know, airy fairy sounding world peace vision, what you recognize is that the things that internally motivate us are the thoughts that we have in our head. And we are all, you know, very capable, beautiful creatures, but we're motivated by insecurity. 85% of the world has low self-esteem. That causes us to act in all kinds of, you know, not necessarily the most giving and loving ways, because we're trying to self-protect constantly. And so when you do the work back and you recognize that as you are able to decrease our fear, our scarcity thinking, our anxiety, we're able to interact with one another far more generously and openly. And when you do the work back to that, you know, what are the tools that allow you to do that? Meditation is obviously a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the neuroscience studies on meditation demonstrate that 8 weeks of meditation can change the connectivity of your neural network. So it increases the density of your gray matter. Meditation also decreases the activation of your amygdala. The amygdala is the fight or flight center, the thing that motivates these fear responses that we have. It thickens your prefrontal cortex, which is your attentional control center, which allows you to actually be patient and engage with a thing rather than moving from one topic to the next in a very scattered approach. So meditation not only changes our sort of feelings and our behaviors and our understanding, but there's actually a neurological change that happens that allows those changes to be a bit more persistent.
Mm.
So, you know, meditation's not going to solve all the world's problems, but being aware of and being more in control of and capable of the way that we manage ourselves and our fears and our anxieties definitely is going to improve the way that we live.
And I don't think that having a lot of stressed out humans is going to solve all the world's problems either. You know, it's an old Einstein quote, you know, you can't solve a problem at the same level of consciousness with which it was created. And so if we start, you know, actually rebuilding the brains of the humans on the planet right now, you know, I agree with you. I think it's at least planting the seeds for the solutions to come. And at the very least, not continuing to act out of, you know, like you said, fear or greed. Because I would argue that a lot of the world's problems, a lot of the messes that we've got ourselves in are greed-based, which is ultimately fear-based.
Mm-hmm. I just came back from a week at TED, listening to TED Talks, and the one thing that I really came away with was the shift in perspective that each TED speaker offers. So you start in the problem state. Here's the problem that we have in the world. And then when you get to the solution state, each and every person rises themselves out of the problem and shifts their perspective to see an entirely new solution.
Mm.
And that's the model. And part of why it's so inspiring is the notion that you can engage that shift in perspective. And rather than being stuck in the problem and just trying to like push the little needle of the problem forward, you can rise three or four levels above it and see how you can create a system-wide change that just dissolves the problem, that just eradicates the problem and makes it irrelevant relative to this new way of thinking about the world.
And then it seems like the possibilities are endless, because how do we even know what solutions will come if we're not operating on that level mentally yet? That feels exciting. But was there one speaker or one idea that really jumped out at you from TED?
Adam Foss was one of my favorite talks. He is a prosecutor who is trying to change the way that the criminal justice system works. So it currently costs about $109,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. And when somebody's incarcerated, you have a mark on your record. It's very difficult to get another job. And typically, you end up back in the criminal justice system. So instead of taking the 18 months that you typically take to prepare for a trial, he actually works with the people that come through the system and says, okay, well, what you actually have is an addiction issue. Let's take the time and energy to find you the right social worker, the right addictions care facility. Let's take that $110,000 and put it towards loving you, rehabilitating you, and actually solving the problem rather than putting you in jail.
Mm.
You think about that $109,000, how you can put that to work over a year. You know, how much psychotherapy you can get for that, how much social work, how much support to the rest of the family, how much nutrition.
How much yoga, how many meditation classes, how many muses can we give those people?
We have a program that's just starting in Miami prisons. It's a really, really small one with youth in a prison there using Muse to deal with their own journey. And it's been very, very early reports are very positive.
Even if it's a small community to start, you know, if you get positive feedback from that, like who knows where it will go. I recently learned that it's somewhere around 90% of people with addiction issues had some sort of childhood trauma.
Yep.
Like the correlation is even more to obesity and sugar. And so it's an interesting way to reframe how we see addiction. If we see that as an almost a byproduct of trauma, mm-hmm. and if we heal that trauma, then maybe we heal the addiction, which probably lessens the chances of incarceration.
Yes. And in addiction, one of the biggest sort of intermediaries between the trauma and the addiction is shame.
Mm.
And so trauma then creates the shame, which then creates the addiction behavior.
Mm.
And so when you put somebody in an incarceration position, you know, you're the continual shaming is not doing anything to solve the problem.
Mm.
And when you live in a world of compassion and non-judgment, that notion of shame also begins to dissolve. And that is so healing.
Mm.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Tell me about your personal practice. What's a day in the life of Aria look like as far as muse, meditation, compassion?
So I wake up in the morning, I lie in my bed, and now that I'm pregnant, the first little bit is spent just talking to the little guy inside.
Great.
And then I get up and move about my day. It seems like 1 in 4 or 5 days is spent on an airplane now, and so that becomes an amazing time to meditate. It's literally 4 hours of being disconnected from everything up in the air, where I think differently and the world is different. So in that time, I will work on talking to my body. It spent focused attention on the breath exercise. It spent musing. So every day has muse in it. Some days it's just for 3 minutes. Some days it's for 45 minutes. So, you know, depends where it fits throughout the day. Sometimes it'll be at the beginning and the end of the day. Sometimes it'll just be in the middle of the day for a quick little muse break that changes state. The muse meditation was a really important part of my meditation journey because prior to muse, I was somebody who really had difficulty meditating. I was one of those people that I now describe where you sit there and your brain's bouncing all over the place and you know what you're supposed to be doing because you've read about it and you know what you're supposed to be doing, but it just is not working. And I'd become very frustrated with myself because I'm supposed to be here and calm and present. And I just keep having these thoughts that like cause me a little bit of anxiety and I want to get up and it's hard to sit. And then you feel defeated and uncomfortable with yourself and like you're a failure. And then the whole gosh darn cycle starts.
Mm-hmm.
And so Muse was the thing that really taught me what to do. Muse was the thing that really showed me like, okay, just bring your attention to your breath. It's safe to be here. It's okay to be in the silence. You can just sit here with it. Prior to that, I, you know, went into a therapist saying, I have ADHD and did a 3-hour test and I was sure that it showed that I had ADHD. And I'm a therapist myself and I know all the signs. And at the end, she's like, no, I can't actually give you a diagnosis.
And you thought you had ADHD because of your meditation experience?
No, or? No, but just in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the level to which, it was really hard to engage in my attention on a single object and to maintain that attention. And then through musing, I was able to build that skill of attention and build that skill of patience and build that skill of bringing my mind back and accepting its wandering. And then I could start engaging other practices and be able to sit comfortably in them and be able to have the presence of mind and the power of mind to really stick with it and get deep into it.
Mm. And have you found that that's most of your users?
So we have tons of Muse users who know that meditation is good for them, have been told by the doctor that they should do it, or you know, they've heard it's fantastic, but just don't know how to get started, mm-hmm. or it seems weird, or it seems scary. And so now their doctor will just hand them a Muse, or their friend will hand them a Muse, and it's like, okay, now I sit down, and it is, you know, you're a manual to a beginning meditation for them. Mm-hmm. And then they learn the practice, and then they can keep going on. For others that already have a meditation practice, it's a thing that gives you a new insight into how your mind works, gives you a new lens or new mirror with which to see your brain activity and to see what your mind does and to really find the edges of your attention and the qualities of your attention. Mm. You know, as meditators, we're consciousness explorers, and this is, you know, an amazing tool in that exploration.
Mm. I love the idea of how you said that you were able to train your attention and you were able to train your patience. And I think that we think oftentimes that our brain is just an organ, or it's just this thing that we're given at birth and it will do whatever it wants. But if we start to really see it as a muscle and that it's changing and that there actually is neuroplasticity and every thought you're thinking and every experience you have is shaping it, we know it in this community, but I'm not sure that everyone really understands just how changeable the brain is. Can you, mm-hmm. can you speak about that a bit?
Absolutely. So when you are meditating, you know, typically your mind wanders. It's your job to notice that it's wandered and to bring it back. And it's actually in the noticing that it's wandered and the act of bringing it back that you are training the muscle of your attention. It is impossible for anybody as a novice to, you know, maintain attention for a long period of time. We have wandering minds, and that's A-okay. The question is, do you have a relationship with it that allows you to then change it and make choices as to how your brain is working, or as to how you are attending to the thing that you care about? With Muse, you notice within seconds that your mind has wandered, and then you very quickly bring it back. So whereas with the regular meditation practice, where it's 1 to 5 minutes, you're like, oh, right, I'm on the grocery list, I'm supposed to be meditating, and you bring it back. In 10 minutes, you might get, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 recoveries. With Muse, you can get 50, 60 recoveries because you're instantly cued and you instantly bring it back. So it really sharpens and hones your ability to understand your wandering mind, mm-hmm. and to practice that muscle of bringing it back. Mm. And once you are able to build that muscle of attention, you can then move it around the room. You can move to open monitoring. You can move your attention around. You can widen the scope, tending to multiple things. You can listen to your thoughts in new ways, knowing that you are not at the mercy of it, but that you can attend to what's going on around you and make choices with it. And then once you have this, you know, trained brain, you've created the ability and the patience to not be distracted by both the external distractions in your environment that can pull us away and, you know, cause us to jump from one thing to the other, and the internal distractions. Now, I call these things distractions, are also wonderful things, the thoughts, the feelings, the stuff that comes up inside. It allows you to be an observer of them rather than being in the throes of it, rather than to be controlled by it. Mm. By training your attention, you can change your relationship to your body and your environment around you.
And how long does it usually take? Like for Muse users, is it 6 weeks? Is it 8 weeks? Is it within a few days that people start to notice shifts in their waking state behavior? Or does it depend on the person?
Like everything, it depends on the person. Mm-hmm. People start to notice pretty quickly that their attention has improved. That was one of the first things that I noticed. So, you know, might be sitting in a lecture and for the very first time realizing, oh, I'm not actually listening. I had a mom say this to me a while ago. After about a week or two of musing, she was in the park with her child. And he's about 2 years old, and it was a beautiful day, and they were playing in the park. And for the very first time, she realized that when she was playing in the park with her kids, she wasn't actually in the park with her kid. Mm. For the very first time, she realized that she had this internal dialogue of grocery list and what I'm going to make for dinner and is that thing safe and she just wasn't present. And she came to me and told me, like, this was the very first time I was able to actually bring myself to presence because I recognized that I wasn't before, mm. and be there with the kid.
Wow. Yeah, because if you don't know that you're not present,
yeah.
then how can you come back?
Yeah.
And I would argue that the more present we are, it's like the present moment is the future in the making. And the higher quality seeds that we plant right now, you know, the more high quality yields we will have to sow in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So that's incredible. And again, the ripple effect of this, we don't know. We don't know what it's going to be because we're just planting these seeds. I mean, yes, this stuff has been going on for thousands of years. Yes, people have been doing it in even the States for decades. But I think that now that we have the neuroscience to back this stuff up, I think that it's going to go more mainstream than ever before. And I think it will have a last. I don't think it's going to be a fad this time. I think it's a trend. And I think it's largely due to neuroscience that we can, you know, you can't, you don't have to meditate, but you can't say that it doesn't work anymore.
Yep.
You know, 10 years ago, you'd be like, well, that's woo-woo, hippy-dippy nonsense, but you can't do that anymore.
No, there's 1,000 published studies demonstrating the impact of meditation across multiple, you know, realms of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite study to quote lately is one that comes out of Harvard. They look at the data from the Partners Healthcare System, which is Women Brigham Hospital, Mass General Hospital, a huge big hospital network. And it demonstrated that 8 sessions of a relaxation response course at the Benson Henry Institute, yoga and meditation, led to a 43% decrease in healthcare costs the following year.
That's awesome.
So now one of the big things that we're seeing is Muse implemented within healthcare systems. And so we have a study running with the Mayo Clinic using Muse with breast cancer patients to demonstrate that using Muse decreases the stress of surgery and potentially improves recovery times. Another one with Harvard working on traumatic brain injury. And then insurers are actually getting on board, running studies with us demonstrating that using Muse decreases their costs and improves the healthy outcomes of their patients.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly see it within my own company. We meditate together regularly. Meditation is such a core part of it. And the trust that we have for one another is so deep, and the ability to listen and the caring that we have for one another. Now, I wouldn't want to be creating an organization any other way.
Why not? It's like we spend 90% of our waking state at work or working. We might as well enjoy it. I teach sometimes meditations at companies, and I love it because then there's this built-in community and they don't have to hide it from their boss. Mm-hmm. They don't have to lie to their coworkers and say they're going out to smoke when actually they're going to meditate. Like it's crazy that a smoke break would be more socially acceptable than a meditation break.
That's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
When we started implementing a regular meditation teacher in the company, that was early on years and years ago, my team is made up of a lot of people, including coders who aren't necessarily always the most communicative. And so we'd sit down in these meditation sessions, and at the end of meditation comes the, what was your experience? How did you feel? And so I'd usually start by modeling it and overshare about my own experience. And then, you know, one by one, watch individuals who, you know, are normally less comfortable with their own internal states and sharing with them, open themselves up and share little bits about their feelings and themselves, and watch their relationships form within the company as people became vulnerable to one another in this very, very safe way and supported one another through their vulnerability.
Bravo. Way to create an incredible life. Bravo on creating an incredible company and a product that's changing the lives of so many. It's a delight to see you as always. I always love learning from you and watching you. And thank you for being here.
Oh, my sincere pleasure. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you all for listening. If you'd like to know more about Ariel or Muse, check out the website at choosemuse.com. I hope you found Ariel's story compelling, and we look forward to sharing more inspiring stories on our next episode. If you have feedback or suggestions for stories, email us at untangle@guyam.com. And don't forget to check out Guyam's Meditation Studio app in the App Store. See you next time.